I could not. Kiana, come on down. Come on down. Not only is she our superstar basketball player, I have something for you.
Oh.
Not only did she make our whole university proud, she also got an A on the midterm.
Oh.
Give it up. I have two daughters who are both athletes. You might imagine they take out with their mother. We couldn't be more proud, Kiana. Thank you for coming tonight. It was a delight to have you. Good luck as you go forward, okay? We all needed to support her. As far as the midterm, all of you did remarkably well. I couldn't be prouder of you. You did awesome. Each got an email. If anybody didn't get it, I put that little box on my U Albany, so everybody should have gotten it. But if you didn't, let me know. Because we'll make sure we have it. If anybody has an instant need for gratification, come on up after class. I'll tell you where you are. But everybody did beautifully. There's no one here that can't still get an A out of this class. I'm thrilled about that. I like it. It makes me happy. If you got a grade which you were not as happy on that you wanted, I believe in redemption. There is a form here for extra credit. You can also download it on the internet. It's on our website. But fill it out, give it back to me, come up with a project that kind of touches on law somehow. We told you, can't be watching an episode of Law and Order, you gotta do something a little bit more than that. But we'll boost your grade up if you do it. Anybody is eligible, come on in, fill it out, we'll take care of it, okay? We will go through the midterm first thing of next class. I still have a couple students who have yet to take it. That's why we can't go through it tonight. I wish you did. But you all have your grades, and if you have any questions, just come up and talk to me after class, shoot me an email, do any of those things. Okay. It's a beautiful day, so we're going to fly through class. Want to get you out back and enjoying it. I can't ever remember. I've lived here most of my life with a brief excursion for law school in Long Island. But I've never remembered a March when it's 80 degrees. So we'll get you out. Enjoy it a little bit. Okay? Last time, before the midterm, we talked and started corporations. We talked about the types of corporations that there are out there. Business corporations, not-for-profits, professional corporations. We talked about what happens in pre-incorporation, how you set it up. The formation of corporations. We talked about property of corporations. Unlike property of partnerships, which is really the property of the partners, the property of a corporation is property of the corporation. It belongs to that person under the law, not to the investors. Corporation is a person. It's got a separate entity in the law. Lastly, we talked briefly about the powers of corporations. Okay? What they do, how they act. Tonight, we're going to talk about two things: shareholder rights and securities regulations. Shareholders, that's how you own the corporation, you divide that up into shares. And securities regulation is how we make sure that those shares, when they're traded, are done so fairly and honestly and above board. There's two levels of regulation. There's state regulation and there's federal regulation. The textbook also talks about industry self-regulation. To be honest with you, that's not regulation. That's just what the industry tries to do to make sure that the business is operating properly. I don't consider that regulation, but we'll talk about it because they are doing things. Okay? Let's jump into it. Okay. How do you own a corporation? We talked about this a little bit the last time. It's stock. You own a share. When they call it a share, what do you think? Remember, words have meaning. Why do you think they call it a share? Because you own a slice of that corporation. You're sharing with the other shareholders. And it means just that. You're sharing. You buy a slice of that corporation. That's what a share does. Okay? So when you buy that stock, you now have an ownership interest in the corporation. You can have two types of stock. Actually, there's more than that. For our purposes, there's two types. One is common stock. Common stock gives you a vote. So you get to elect the board of directors. You get to do certain items that they'll have a vote on of the shareholders. You get control. When you have a vote, that gives you power. Common stock is the control of the corporation. If you own the common stock, you're in the catbird seat because you control it. Okay? Preferred stock is usually not voting stock, but it has a higher level when it comes to getting dividends. What is dividends? We'll get to that in a minute, but basically a dividend is when the company makes money and they share it with their shareholders. Okay? It's a declared income that they distribute. Preferred is just that. If you're a preferred shareholder, you're first in line to get that dividend. Sometimes they can't give it to everyone. Sometimes they can only give it to the preferred shareholders. They stand first in line. But remember, they generally don't get a vote. They just get the money first. Okay? And they don't have the ownership interest the way their common stockholder has. They just basically get the money. You have what? We'll get to that in a minute, but generally, yes. You get the number of votes that you have, and different states' laws are different. But by and large, the general rule is, if you have 50,000 shares, guess what? You get 50,000 votes. That's why people like George Steinbrenner got to control the New York Yankees. Because he got more than one vote. If you own a share of Yankee stock, you won't get a vote. But he gets more than you. As he did, because now his sons get more than you. Why? Because he has more stock. Stock depends on the number of votes you have. If you have more than anybody else, guess what? You control the corporation. Okay. Par value is the value of the stock. That's the value the corporation sets on the stock. If I set a par value of $3 a share, that's how much it's worth. That's different than the book value. The book value is based on the company's assets. Par is an artificial number. It's supposed to relate back to that value, but it doesn't really frequently do so. Okay? It's an artificial number that is picked. Both of those are different than market value. Market value is what your shares are traded at when you go to sell them on the open market. And that value can be far different than the actual value of the corporation. When a company like Google first got started, its assets were very small, didn't have a lot of money, but it had a lot of potential. So its stock was selling for far more, had a higher market value than its assets. Because people saw that potential and said, I want to invest, I want to be part of that. So during what they called the dot-com era, which was mid to late 90s or the 00s, you have a lot of internet companies like Google having market values far greater than their assets. There was something called the dot-com bubble, where a lot of these internet companies people speculated on. Some of them went under, some of them made a lot of money. That's business. That's the way it goes. People who invested in Microsoft and in Google, John, made a lot of bananas, didn't they? They did well, okay? People who invested in some of the other companies that you've never heard of because they went south didn't do so well, okay? I think my portfolio was more the latter than the former, but we'll see. Okay. Common stock is ordinary stock. It has no preferences. It's equal with all others. But it entitles the holder to what? Control. You participate in the operation of the corporation by voting for the board of directors and anything they put up for a vote to the shareholders. Okay? You share in the profits of the corporation in the form of dividends. You also share in a distribution. Yes? I did not know that, but thank you. I appreciate you telling me that. Heaven's sakes. Says it's on. We'll fix that. And thank you for telling me. That's when you need... That's why I'm not a mom, because I don't have eyes in the back of my head. Hopefully they'll come up in a minute. Okay? Let's get back to comments. I'm sorry? They're what? They're up now? Heaven's sakes, it's turning off. It's going to go down in a minute. But anyway, we'll get it back up. Common stock allows you to share in the profits, allows you to share in the dividends, allows you to participate upon dissolution of the assets of the corporation. So if the corporation either gets bought out or dissolves, you get payments if there's any money there. Okay? Common stock is voting stock. That's where it comes from. Okay? Preferred stock has priority over common stock with regard to dividends, and it's acquired by subscription of an original issue. Okay? Subscription is where you buy it from the company. You can buy common stock that way too, but subscription is when you buy it from the company. It's not when you buy it from somebody else. Okay? Preferred stock is sold by subscription, okay? Or you can also sell it by transferring it the same way you can with common stock. Okay. At least we're coming up now. Okay. Bonds. What's a bond? Bonds are not shares of corporations. Bonds are where you lend that corporation money. It's an IOU. Okay? It's evidence of the indebtedness. That's what a bond does. A bond is a creditor, not an owner. I give you a bond of a corporation, GE. Guess what? It's the same way as if GE and you had a contract to pay them back money. Okay? You're going to lend them that. They're going to give you an interest rate for lending them it. So if you turn around and purchase that bond, they'll turn around and pay you interest on it. Okay? That's what a bond does. You're not an owner. You're a creditor. Okay? All right. They have no voting rights because you're not an owner. How do you acquire shares? Once again, we said there's two ways. Subscription is when you buy it from the company. Either at an original sale, when the company goes and sells its shares in the beginning, or some later date, because sometimes they hold shares in reserve. They don't sell all their stock, they can sell it at a later date. Sometimes they issue more shares. Now, we're not going to get into that too much because you're not allowed to devalue the shares of the existing owners. So if I issue more shares They can't devalue your ownership interest. So what you have to do is you have to provide those who already have an ownership with more shares so that everything equals out. Okay? It's called a stock split. That's what happens. Okay? Again, with subscriptions, you could have pre-incorporation before the corporation comes on, or post-incorporation. Okay? Under the statute of frauds, when you go to buy stock, you have to do it in writing. It is required that they give you an evidentiary paper written and signed by the party to be charged, which in this case is the corporation. The secretary of the corporation will sign the share. It's right on the stock certificate. Okay? Under the statute of frauds, it's got to be in writing. You can't have an oral contract to own a share of a corporation. Okay? If you go and have a contract with your broker, it doesn't have to be in writing. Why? Anybody tell me? Yes?
Because he's an agent?
Exactly. Now, the contract to buy the share still has to be in writing. But the contract with the broker to buy it on your behalf does not have to be. Okay? Because you're merely hiring him or her as an agent. Okay? Very good. A plus. Okay? Transfers of shares. Sometimes when you transfer shares between each other, okay? I own a set of stock in GE, and I turn around and say, well, I'm buying my GE stock. Now, I can do that through a stock exchange. I can do it through a private sale. I can do it through a brokerage house. Okay? But what happens to the dividends when you sell those things? Because this becomes an issue. Who gets the dividend and when? If I sell you my stock on March 21st, for example, okay, and the corporation declares a dividend payable to shareholders on March 15th, but the cash is not distributed to April 5th, I still receive the cash. Why? Because it was declared when I still owned the stock. Okay? The fact that it wasn't paid out until later, at the time they declared the dividend, I was still the shareholder. Okay? If the corporation declared a cash dividend on March 20th, again before, to be paid to those who will be holders on April 15th, you get it. Why? Because it's to be paid out at that later date and announced at the time of the dividend. So I know that selling the stock. Okay? I know I'm not getting it. Thirdly, if the corporation declares a stock dividend on March 10th and the stock is distributed, this is not a dividend, this cash. This is a dividend of stock. Guess what? At the time they declare the stock and provide it, you're the owner, so you get it. Okay? So the only time I get it is when they declare it before and pay it out after. Okay? Okay. What are the rights of a shareholder? I own a share in the corporation. What does that entitle me to? First, I get a stock certificate. I get a little piece of paper signed by the secretary. It tells me I own a share in the corporation. Okay? That's signed by the corporate secretary, remember. I'm allowed thereafter to transfer that. I can sell it on the open market. I can sell it privately, as we said. I can go back and do it through a broker. That's how most people do it. Okay? A corporation, which is a closed corporation, there's business corporations, as we've talked about, have different entities. I can be a public corporation and have a public offering. That means I offer my shares to everyone in the free world, anybody who wants to buy. but something like a General Electric Company, a Microsoft, big corporations. They offer it to everybody. They don't care who buys their stock. Just give us money and you invest. We're global corporations. We want to do that. Everybody knows these IPOs, so the public offerings, offer it to everybody. You're now regulated by the SEC if you do that. We'll talk to that in a little bit. Or I can be a closed corporation. Bob's Donuts. The only people who own the corporation are me and my employees. Okay? I can restrict who I sell that to. I can say the only people who buy the corporation have to be named by and work for me. Maybe we'll let in some of the reverters too. The end of the day, corporations like this, one of the big local ones is Price Chopper, that's owned by the Golub family. You have to either be a member of the Golub family or you have to be an employee of the Golub's corporation to be able to buy stock in Price Chopper. Okay? Voting. Shareholders control the corporation indirectly. Remember, it's not a direct vote. They control it indirectly by electing directors. It's a Republican form. When I mean Republican, I don't mean Republican versus Democrat. I mean they elect representatives at the board of directors, and they turn around and represent you as a shareholder. And they have duties back and forth. Remember that reciprocal duty thing? Guess what? It works in corporations land too. As a shareholder, you have a duty to them, and they have a duty back to you. There's fiduciary duties back and forth. You elect the board of directors, they do your bidding. You asked before about cumulative voting. That's votes based on the number of shares owned. Most times, that's how corporations work. You own 50,000 shares, you get 50,000 votes. Okay? Voting by proxy, when you have a share in a corporation, they have a shareholders meeting. That's when they conduct those elections of the board of directors. They'll actually get together in a room. Most people don't go to the shareholders meeting. Even if those shares in the corporation, what you do is you get a written ballot in the mail. You fill that out. You sign your name and you send it in. That is a proxy. It's a vote sheet. You don't have to be present to vote. You can vote by, in effect, an absentee ballot, which is a proxy sheet. Okay? Sorry?
What if you don't vote?
Then you lose your right to vote. Same way as an election. You don't vote, you snooze, you lose. Okay? You don't vote, you can't do it later. There's a time frame on that proxy. But if you fill it out and send it in, your vote gets counted based on the number of shares you own. Okay? So if you have 50,000 shares, your proxy that you send in, and you don't send in 50,000 proxies, they don't make you do that. Okay? You only have to send in one, but it gets 50,000 votes. There you go. Okay? You can also have voting agreements and trusts. This got a number of people into trouble around the turn of the century. There was something known as the Sherman Antitrust Act. What happened was John Rockefeller and several others formed agreements on how they would collaboratively work to form monopolies on trust through these voting agreements. You got to be careful because they're regulated under federal law. The Antitrust Act basically said you can't do this to form a monopoly. Teddy Roosevelt became president in his second term by busting trusts. He was known as Teddy the Trust Buster. So you have to be careful when you form these trusts and these voting agreements. They can't be used for a monopoly. Okay. Dividends. A dividend is a distribution of the portion of the corporation's earnings, and it's put out to its shareholders. So if I'm General Electric Company, and I've made a lot of money this year, sold a lot of light bulbs, okay? I could turn around and say, shareholders, you participated in that, you bought my stock, really happy on that. I have $600 million worth of profit this year, and I have 600 million shareholders out there, not individual, but people who own shares. So I'm going to give them each a buck. Because we have that extra cash on hand. That's a dividend. Okay? It's a distribution of the profits of the company. Okay? Generally, a dividend is only a small portion of the profits. Okay? There's a lot of other things that the company can do with the profits. Reinvest it back in the company, expand, they can hire more employees, they can pay its directors more. Directors generally do not work for free. Okay? Shareholders have a right to receive dividends when they're declared, but that declaration is at the discretion of the directors. If a company makes a profit, it does not have to declare a dividend. That being said, there's a fiduciary duty of the directors back to the shareholders. When you're a director, you work for the shareholders. That's your boss. Why? They elect you. So if you're never declaring a dividend, and that was expected at the time you sold the stock, guess what? You think they're going to be happy with it? They're going to complain, right? Shareholders actually have the right to sue the directors. They have the right to fire them. So if you're not declaring dividends, and that's expected, and in some industries it is more than others, okay? There's remedies that you have as a shareholder to get them to do that. In many states, the security statute provides that no dividend may be declared unless the corporation has what is called an earned surplus. That means that not only have they had a good year, but they have a positive balance sheet. So even though they may have had a whopping good year, they had three whopping bad years before that, they can't declare the dividend. Depends on the state statute for that. New York does not have that restriction. Shareholders may bring a derivative action. Derivative actions are when you turn around and sue the corporate directors based on the fact that they have committed a breach of their fiduciary duty on you. Those actions are not frequent. Why? If they tell me why it's not very often that they'll sue the board of directors. Anybody know? Yeah, you could just vote them out of office. The problem is, though, and why these actions do exist, is because sometimes you have a whole lot of little shareholders as opposed to a lot of big ones. And if you have a whole lot of little shareholders, their small number of votes individually have a hard time influencing that board of directors. Well, it's the old adage, if you have 50,000 bosses, you have none. Okay? So there was a big movement in the 1970s to push for these shareholder derivative actions. What has happened now, through the advancements of communication, now the internet, Facebook, and everything else, suddenly the unhappy General Electric Company shareholders form a Facebook page. And they all get together and say, let's vote these guys out of office. Guess what? They suddenly decide they're going to declare a dividend. Okay? So there's other remedies that you have there. So these shareholder derivative actions, which incidentally, and I can tell you as a lawyer, most of the time the lawyers make most of the money, not the shareholders. Okay? It's not really a good way to go about it. But at the end of the day, it's still something out there if you want to take advantage of it. Okay. What's the liability of a shareholder? We've talked up to now about benefits. What liabilities do you have? Well, the whole purpose of forming a corporation, one of the basic purposes is to limit your exposure. When I was running Bob's Donuts by myself as a sole proprietor, all the responsibility was on my shoulders to my creditors. When I own a corporation, my responsibilities are only limited to that of my investment. That is the limitation of liability. That's the beautiful aspect of a corporation, why you want to form the corporate format. So as a shareholder, you're only out the amount of money that you paid for the stock. There are exceptions, though. Fraud and misconduct being two of them. If I turn around, I'm running Bob's Donuts, I have all the debts up to the ceiling, I'm basically bankrupt, and I form a corporation with one shareholder, Bob, for the purposes of trying to get out of all this debt and transfer all the assets, all the liabilities, and everything to the corporation, that's a sham. It's not really a corporation. I just tried to avoid the liability of the creditors. What do you think the law is going to do on that? What's your guess? Yes? Right. It's going to do what they call pierce the corporate veil. I was playing a game. And the law doesn't like fraud. I didn't form that corporation for the purposes of growing my products and franchising it out. I formed it so the corporate creditors, which were my creditors 5 minutes ago, wouldn't come and take my house. Under that basis, because I did it fraudulently, they can pierce the corporate veil. They can still go after me. Okay? Shareholders are ordinarily protected by law. Under these circumstances, however, they could turn around and pierce the corporate veil. Okay? What are some of the areas where they can do it? I just described one. But there's some others. If I never maintain corporate records, if I continue to operate the corporation, let's say I form the corporation in faith, I have a dream of growing Bob's Donuts. I want to make it into the best donut shop in the world. But I got a lot more dreams than I do talent or intelligence. Okay? What can I do here? What if I never keep a corporate record? I never have a shareholders meeting. It's all kind of in a bottom drawer someplace, and all I'm doing is baking the donuts. Guess what? The creditors can say that is not really a corporation. You're not operating through a board of directors. You don't really have any shareholders. Guess what? You're not doing it. When you turn around and commingle the assets, if all of a sudden I have the corporation buy my house and my car, and I'm using it as a personal financial vehicle, okay, on everything I own and do, commingling of assets can be a justification to pierce the corporate veil. Grossly inadequate capitalization. There is no money put in to the corporation. Okay? It's all a dollar and a dream. If people are stealing, the board of directors has their hand in the cookie jar. Formation of a corporation, as we said, to avoid existing obligations. That was the first example. And lastly, this is a catch-all, which is almost never used, but it's out there. Injustice would result if the corporate entity were recognized. That's an equitable remedy.
Remember, the law does want to be fair, but that's rarely recognized because it's kind of too squishy, to be honest with you.
Courts are reluctant to pierce the corporate veil. They have a high degree of respect for corporations. They are a person under the law and they want to do it. Okay. What are some of the other instances for liability of shareholders? These are imposed by law. If you have wage claims that you have not paid your workers, under federal and state law, you gotta pay the workers. Excuse me. If they don't get paid, guess what? They can pierce the corporate veil and go after the shareholders. Unpaid subscriptions. What does that mean? I turned around and bought stock but didn't pay the corporation for it. Well, guess what? They can recoup that money back from the shareholders. You owed it in the first place. All you're doing is collecting on what you promised to pay. And lastly, unauthorized dividends. If they turn around, this is really theft. If they turn around and pay a dividend that they shouldn't have paid. Okay? Lastly, when you have a professional corporation, like a law practice, a medical practice, an engineering practice, I'm an engineer. I skip the Bob's Donuts idea and decide to open up Bob's Engineering Inc. PC. Okay? Now, I'm not an engineer, but I go online and get an engineering degree from XYZ Online University. Suddenly, I'm an engineer. I design a building. But the first time there's a windstorm, collapses. That can be malpractice. I can't form a PC for the purposes of avoiding malpractice. Similarly with a doctor, similarly with a lawyer. Okay? You can avoid liability if somebody slips and falls on the steps of your doctor's office, but if you cut off the right leg as opposed to the left leg, guess what? You still have liability on that corporation for malpractice. Okay? Any questions? Okay. We're now into the second part of this dance, two-step dance. Securities regulations. We want to make sure that these shares are traded and purchased knowingly. When you invest in a corporation, we want to make sure that what you're buying, you know what it is. Right? You don't want to buy something, you don't know what it is. So what does the securities regulation do? It tries to inform the investor. That's the principal goal of securities regulation. They call the state laws of security regulation blue sky laws. Why? When you have a blue sky, what happens? What happens when you have a blue sky? You can see the sunshine, right? Sunshine lights it up. You can see clearly, you know everything that's going on. This is the early 20th century, 19th century version of transparency. We want people to know what they're buying. The blue sky laws are state securities regulation laws. Okay? In New York State, we have the most powerful blue sky law in the nation. It was formed before all federal regulation. It was enacted in 1921, before the stock market crash in 1929. It was enacted when times were very good in America and in New York State in particular. The Martin Act is the most powerful securities statute in the United States, I dare say, even in the world. The federal regulations were modeled after it and are weaker than it.
Matter of fact, the Attorney General of the state of New York, who has the authority to enforce the Martin Act, is one of the most powerful offices in the United States because of this issue. Where is the New York Stock Exchange? Anybody?
New York.
Very good. Even though it's threatened to move to New Jersey, it's still in New York. So guess what? The Martin Act has jurisdiction over the New York Stock Exchange. And there's a reason for this, not just the fact that it's in New York, but because of the fact that the Martin Act was written to have jurisdiction over it, because the New York Stock Exchange pre-existed the Martin Act. So every single transaction that occurs on the New York Stock Exchange, which is the American Stock Exchange largest player, and you have Amex, NASDAQ, but by and large, the New York Stock Exchange is the largest one, and that's in New York City. Okay. Under the Martin Act, the AG has the legal authority to monitor securities transactions. They can look into that. They have registration powers. If you're a not-for-profit charity, you have to register with the state attorney general. It's required. If you do not do that, your corporation can be dissolved. For business corporations, they can not only monitor what you do, they can also bring lawsuits for fraud and violations and enforcement of the Martin Act. The Martin Act is contained in New York's general business law. We also in New York State have a Department of Financial Regulation. It was created last year. I wrote it. It was a bill that was contained last year in our budget that merged the banking and insurance departments. It's located in the city of New York, but one of the powers we gave to this new entity, in addition to continuing the responsibilities of regulating banks and insurance companies in New York, was to also regulate all financial products that are not regulated either by the Martin Act or by federal law. There's a growing number of these products because we live in a complicated financial marketplace. Have things like sophisticated derivatives, which are not exactly shares. They're packaged products. They're created. And some of those sophisticated products are not regulated. This new entity can regulate them. It's operated out of the city of New York, and it's headed by a gentleman by the name of Ben Lawsky. Put him on your radar screen. I think he could end up being either Attorney General or the Governor. Okay. Securities regulation under federal law. Prior to 1933, there was no federal regulation whatsoever of securities in the United States. It was all done under state law. The stock market crashed in 1929. And I'll tell you a quick story. Anybody know, you don't remember him personally. I don't either because you killed when I was young. But President Kennedy, his father was a big financial magnate, one of the wealthiest men in the United States, Joseph Kennedy. He was heavily invested in the stock market. And in 1929, he was getting a shoe shine on Broadway, New York City. The shoe shine boy asked him for a stock tip. Joseph Kennedy looked at the shoe shine boy and said, "Why would you want a stock tip?" He says, "I want one instead of the tip you'll give me because I'm invested in the stock market." Joseph Kennedy immediately went in and withdrew all of his money from the stock market. 6 weeks later, the stock market crashed. One of the reasons for the 1929 crash was there was no regulation whatsoever of stocks. Even under the Martin Act, what happened was you did not have blue skies. Speculation was rampant. There was no control, no monitoring, no oversight. Now, we live in a free society. We don't want hyper-regulation of any business. That being said, when nobody was watching a store whatsoever, what happened was you had such speculation, the market crashed. In 1929, you immediately lost an enormous percentage of the value of the stock market, which incidentally didn't come up to that same level that it was in 1929 until over 20 years later. It was a long, long time. Okay. In 1933, after the election of a brand new president, only weeks after his election, Franklin Roosevelt proposed federal regulation of securities. It was enormously controversial. It was sued on. It went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. And what happened? The United States Supreme Court determined that it was engaged in regulation of interstate commerce, and it was something the federal government can do. There are still legal commentators to this day who argue that point. And I'll leave that to yourself, whether or not which side you go on. I can tell you there's very bright minds on both sides. The first act was the Securities Act of 1933. We'll get into that in depth in a second. The second act, it was a 1-2 punch, came the next year, which was the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And since then, there were no acts passed before 2002 on this in a major way. There was Sarbanes-Oxley that came in 2002. Any of you in this classroom that wish to be an accountant need to pay attention to that, because the first thing it did, I can tell you, my wife tells me this every day, she says it knocked the stuffing out of accountants. Unfairly. More recently, you had the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. Don't be surprised if that ends up getting repealed, because both sides, both consumer advocates and businesses, hate it uniformly. I don't know who actually likes it. The term security has been defined as stocks, bonds issued by a corporation. It's both of them. Other definitions may also seek to enter other financial products. As we said, sophisticated products sometimes are included within those definitions, sometimes are not. Under state law, as we said, for Department of Financial Regulation, we included them. But guess what? The federal statutes are constantly being updated and amended. Don't be surprised if you see that come in. We'll see. Let's talk about the first Securities Act of 1933. Basically, its provisions regulate the issuance. This is when you absolutely have the creation of the stock for the first time. It's the original distribution by issuing corporations. So when I turn around and create Bob's Donuts and I do a stock issuance, that's what this statute regulates. The primary purpose of it, just like the blue sky laws, are to make sure that the people who buy that stock know what they're buying. Okay? That's what they do. It's legally founded, as we said, in the Interstate Commerce Clause. And the principal way that this works is by means of a registration statement. When I turn around and issue that stock, I register with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I have to issue what is known as a prospectus.
Anybody know what a prospectus is? Anybody have a guess? Yes.
Is it
a prospectus is a document produced by the corporation basically telling it the prospective purchasers of the stock what the game plan is for the corporation. This is what we want to do. This is why we're selling the stock. This is what the corporation wants to achieve. It tells the story of the corporation, why it's being formed, and why you're issuing the stock. Okay?
That's what a prospectus does. Okay? Okay. The number one thing on, if you're regulated, and not every corporation is, we'll get to this in a minute, is the registration statement. You have to fill out with the SEC all kinds of information that tells about what your corporation's doing and what they're doing. You have to tell them with the prospectus, not only you file the prospectus with the SEC, you also have to do that prospectus to anybody who's issued your issued shares. So they know what you're doing. This is only for either large scale or public offerings. Okay?
And believe me, whenever you register with the federal government, lots of paperwork involved. It's part of their charter.
What are the exceptions? Regulation A provides for a simplified registration statement if you're doing a public offering where issuances are up to $5 million. Okay? Those issuances do not include testing the waters. So if you're just going around and saying, hey, listen, if I did a stock option at $50 a share, would you buy it? That's not included. Okay? It's only where you turn around and actually issue the stock up to $5 million. Regulation A says you got to do an abbreviated form. Okay? Regulation D provides blanket exceptions, and they're as follows. Private placement. If I don't offer the stock to the general world through an IPO, a public offering, okay, I don't have to file. An offer need not register where their private placement is occurring. Okay? Accredited investors, if I'm saying you're able to pay for this, you are an investor who is knowledgeable, you know what you're buying, I'm only giving this to certain people. I'm only offering it to people who are named Bob, who know how to bake donuts. Guess what? That's not covered. Limited offerings. You can offer it more broadly to more than just people named Bob who bake donuts, but there's certain parameters under which you don't hit. These are additional thresholds. If you sell less than $1 million in securities in 12 months, okay? It's basically a small public offering. Okay? I only need to raise $1 million for Bob's Donut Shop. I don't need more than that. And I'm only going to sell this for 12 months. Guess what? I don't have to raise. Okay? Or if it's less than $5 million to no more than 35 people in a 12 month period. Okay? The 1 million could be to 1 million people, give me each a buck. Okay? But the 5 million has to be to 35 or less. Okay? Liability. The 33 Act imposes civil liability if you are making a material false statement, pretty serious charges. This is, again, why did we have registration? It's not to make a corporation go through hoops, it's to turn the sunlight on. Okay? That's the purpose of it. So if you omit a material statement, or if you lie or commit fraud, guess what? You're going to get nailed. Okay. What's the 34 Act do? Remember, there was the first one that tries to, that's registration, shines the light on it for the initial public offering. The 34 Act dealt with trading stock. Because that's what really was the problem in the stock market crash. It wasn't an issue of initial public offerings.
The 33 Act really didn't do anything to address the stock market crash of 29. It just set up a regulatory framework for regulation on the federal level. Okay? The 34 Act tried to get at the issues of the 29 crash. And what did it do?
Actually, that says 1920, and I'm sorry, I got to correct it. It's 29 that they did.
What does it do? It says we're going to regulate the secondary distribution of the sales of securities.
This is not the initial public offering. It's after it's been offered, and then you put it back on the market. The New York Stock Exchange, you turn around and sell it to somebody else. Okay?
That's why it's called the Exchange Act, because you're transferring stock amongst yourselves. Okay?
It's designed to prevent fraudulent and manipulative procedures in the selling of stock between parties. Not between the corporation and an investor, but between individual investors. Why? In 29, you had a huge number of speculation. This was designed to prevent that problem. They said an informed investor is the person who's going to make good investments. You're not going to have that speculation. This requires it. Okay?
Exchanges, that's like the New York Stock Exchange, brokers, people who trade these to make money on it, and dealers offering securities traded on a national security exchange, like the New York Stock Exchange, or if they're offering them privately in interstate commerce, okay? I turn around and I'm selling it to people in Ohio, okay? They must register with the SEC under this 34 Act. Registration is also required for companies, okay? When their securities are listed on the national exchange.
So if I'm a public company, like a General Electric company, and I'm sold on what is known as the big board, guess what? I have to also register. Why? Because I have an interest in how my stock is being traded. Because if I want to reissue it, or if I want to buy it back, I'm going to have to pay that market price. The market price is cared for. That's why they really care about that. Okay?
Okay. Sarbanes-Oxley. We had a long period of time
from 1934 to 2002 when there wasn't any major, there was some minor changes, but wasn't any major acts to change the securities world.
The 33 and 34 Act were tweaked at the edges and they had many amendments. I'm not going to say they didn't. But by and large, you didn't have a whole new regulatory framework. 2002, you had things like Enron and WorldCom, well before most of you guys were paying attention to these things. But they were big financial scandals involving big corporations, and Washington got together, the Republican House and the Democrat Senate, and said, we have to fix this. Well, according to my wife, and I only go by her, they said they knocked the stuffing out of accountants in it. Didn't do much good. I don't know. I can tell you that some of the things they did appear to be valuable, but I will tell you what they did do. It's a very broad-based statute. It provides for criminal penalties and also further federal regulation, oversight. What they require is for corporate officers, two of them, the chief financial officer and the chief executive officer, to certify their reports. A corporation does an annual report by law. It's part of the SEC, part of the 34 Act. If you're turning around and trading on the big board, you got to do annual reports. It's also in many state and corporation statutes. Those annual reports have to now be certified, sworn to,
by the chief financial officer and the chief executive officer. If they lie in those reports, that's what happened in WorldCom and Enron. If they lie in those reports, those people can go to jail. Matter of fact, the head of both those corporations were prosecuted. Okay? Under different statutes, because this didn't exist at the time they broke the law. Okay? Additionally, okay, there's serious penalties for a willful or a knowing misrepresentation in any of these reports. Okay. Lastly, you have recently the Dodd-Frank Act. The Dodd-Frank Act was very broad. And it did not only investor issues, but it all, you know, tried to regulate hedge funds, private equity funds, which were not covered under these previous acts. It added a new definition of accredited investor. Those are the people who are exempted under the 33 Act. It provides for more reports of public companies, gave incentives for a business to go out there and lend more money, including banks, to underprivileged individuals. This act has been widely criticized for not only its breadth, but for its lack of forethought. A lot of people on economists on both the left and the right, they're both shooting at it, saying it needs to be repealed. A lot of the consumer groups say it didn't go far enough, that it's not helping anybody. A lot of the people on the other side are saying it's killing business. One of the things it created was this new entity it's a private corp. It's a not-for-profit corporation, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. This has been a real big issue out there in Washington the last few weeks because the head of it was done by a recess appointment. So it's being sued whether or not it can even come into existence. At the end of the day, this statute is pretty broad, and it does touch on securities regulation. Don't be surprised if it at least gets changed with the next Congress. And I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, it's probably going to get changed. Okay? How it gets changed is a different story, but we'll see how long it is. Okay. There's a lot of anti-fraud provisions in both the Martin Act and in the federal securities laws. They prevent fraud. That's one of the reasons why they turn around and put light on it. You have both civil and criminal sanctions where you're incurring with fraud. And what it, fraud and misrepresentation is how you commit fraud. Fraud is the act on what you do. Misrepresentation is the intentional misrepresentation of a material fact. That's what fraud is. That's what you're doing here. What does the Martin Act do for fraud? In Section 352, it allows the AG to bring lawsuits so they can actually sue the company and say, stop doing that because we think it's fraud. It can recoup money back for investors by doing it, by suing them. Okay? As we said, it's been described as a fearsome enforcement tool, most powerful state statute in the country, even more powerful than the federal regulations. The anti-fraud organization on the federal government, the fraud anti-fraud regulator, is the SEC, the Securities Exchange Commission. Okay? Like the Martin Act, they have criminal and civil penalties that they can impact on these people who are committing fraud. Okay? Rule 10B5 is the anti-fraud rule under the 34 Act. That's where it comes from. Okay? It should be noted that the SEC regulates cash tender offers, which are more than just stock sales. You're just basically offering to do it. Okay? Let's talk for a minute about insider trading. You cannot, as someone within the corporation, use inside information to benefit you personally in the sale of securities. you will go to jail. You cannot use inside information to benefit you personally.
What does that mean? If I am a director of a corporation, and I know
that my corporation was going to manufacture a car that ran on water, and I got the engineering report back, and my stock is trading for $200 a share. Everybody thinks that the high price of gas is a great idea. I have all kinds of great press releases out there the last several months. This car is coming. I just get an engineering report as head of this company that the engine's not working. And I know as soon as that report gets released to the public, my shares are going to go from $200 to $100 overnight. Because people know that this is going to have a longer road than we thought. I cannot go out based on that information and sell my shares the night before that's released to prevent that $100 loss. Martha Stewart did just that. She had information that was given to her by her broker that one of her companies, which she owned an awful lot of stock in, was going to plummet the next day. She sold it. She was convicted for doing such. One of the biggest insider trading cases out there. She was actually convicted on conspiracy rather than insider trading. But at the end of the day, she had to do 5 months in jail. Insider trading is not a good idea. Now, there are some exceptions. If I have no fiduciary duty, you can't be insider trading. I'll give you an example. I happen to be the custodian for Yale Raff Motors. And I take a look at that car and say, you know what? Ugliest thing I've ever seen in my life. I was emptying the trash the other day, and I think it's ugly. Wouldn't buy it. Now, I have no engineering background, I know nothing about this report, and I turn around the next day and I sell my shares. Guess what? That's not insider trading. Okay? You have to have a fiduciary duty to the corporation in order to have that be true. Okay?
Misappropriation. This is when you're stealing. Stealing's never a good idea. But you can also get added on to the problem when you're doing it to a corporation. Okay? If you have a fiduciary duty and you steal the assets of the corporation, you will be held accountable. And if you're a public corporation, SEC will go get you. The Attorney General will get you in New York if you're not. Okay? What are some examples of this? We talked earlier. I form Bob Stoda's and I turn around and buy Bob Stoda's house. I buy Bob Stoda's car. Everything that I take out of that corporation, even though I have shareholders, I'm taking it out for my personal benefit. Okay? That's not kosher. You don't want to do that. I can't misappropriate the money. Okay? Disclosure of ownership. A disclosure statement is required of corporate directors who own equity shares in their corporation so that they don't have conflicts of interest. These are public disclosure statements that are filed with the SEC if you're public. They can also be filed in certain cases with the Attorney General. Okay? Shareholders owning more than 10% in any class of the stock also have to do. The reason for this, again, why do we call these blue sky laws, either on the federal or the state level? The state ones are the ones that are called it, but why do we call it that? We want transparency. That'll do this. Okay? Okay. Regulation of accountants. I know some here want to be that. Sarbanes-Oxley rules provide for disclosure to require accountants to reveal market risk information. Sometimes they were sweeping things under the rug. They're your clients. They pay the bill. They ask you to paint it in the best possible light. The rules now under Sarbanes-Oxley is you have very little discretion on that. Okay? They apply 90% to two forms of accountancy. One is auditing, the other is consulting. Okay, they've taken away a lot of ability to do the consulting, which most of the big four were getting into in a very heavy level. Okay? They also talk about how these accountants deal with derivatives. And lastly, what they do is they require a change in audit personnel every 5 years. That is very controversial, and I'll tell you why. The reason why they did it, the thought behind Sarbanes-Oxley in doing this, was they thought that the auditor who was there for more than 5 years would be very comfortable with the client. They'd have a relationship built with them over that period of time, and as a result of that, they wouldn't be as hard on that person who you're doing the audit on. Become comfortable with them. You know them. You know the kids. You know the background. The problem with this, however, has become the fact that sometimes on more sophisticated audits, you don't have experienced personnel. Sometimes it takes more than 5 years to know the ins and outs of all this. So by doing this, you're actually trading over more inexperienced auditors for the experience. So it's a trade-off. The federal regulators believe that it was a good idea. There's a lot of dispute that you ought to actually make it longer or at least just be able to ship out partners as opposed to people who are doing the compliance work. At the end of the day, it's the law. You have to comply with it. Okay? Okay. Arbitration. This is the self-regulation that the textbook talks about. I can tell you I don't believe this is regulation. I do believe it's a relationship between the shareholders and the corporation. Corporations want happy shareholders for the very reason that they're elected. If I'm a member of the board of directors, my job is dependent on happy shareholders. So we don't want to have unhappy shareholders. What's the best way to deal with that? It's not lawsuits. It's not contested elections where you have a shareholders meeting and everybody's angry. It's to try and resolve disputes. And one of the ways they do that is arbitration. By a dispute between the corporation and the shareholders, arbitration is one of the ways you can settle. In arbitration, unlike court, one party picks their arbitrator, another party picks their arbitrator, and those two arbitrators come together and pick a third. That three-person panel decides what's fair. And that determination is based upon the evidence presented. It is an adjudicatory procedure. It's not exactly a trial, but it's similar. And those three people get together and make that decision. People tend to respect arbitration far more than even courts, because what happens is you are the guys who select the three-judge panel by and large. Your opponent selects one, you select one, and they selected it together. So their response back is something that you can do. Okay. Courts, because of the fact that it is not one-sided, that it is an adjudicatory procedure, and that they have records of these things, seldom overturn arbitrations. It can be done if there's an abuse of discretion, if there's one more powerful person in the room than the others, and if they haven't followed the law. But by and large, arbitrations are highly respected in courts. Okay? Okay. That's it. Anybody have a question? Go out and enjoy the day. I'm so proud of how well you did on the midterm. Thank you.